Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
The fear among the Somali community is real. Like, this mall, if you come to, like, around noon, nobody's here. It is deserted. Every business is closed, and it has been like this for the last 3 days.
Federal immigration agents have reportedly begun operations targeting the Somali community in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. After President Trump repeatedly attacked Somalis, describing them as garbage. We'll speak with Omar Fateh, the first Somali American to be elected to the Minnesota State Senate. Then, to Trump's move to, quote, permanently pause migration from all third world countries, unquote. We'll speak with Murad Awalda of the New York Immigration Coalition about the new rules, as well as an anti-ICE protest here in New York, where protesters halted a potential ICE raid by preventing agents from leaving a Manhattan parking lot.
So while this operation was meant to inflict fear, chaos, and panic, New Yorkers stepped up. And New Yorkers defended one another, making sure that no one was taken and disappeared from their communities and their families.
Then to Matt Duss of the Center for International Policy on negotiations to end the war in Ukraine, as well as a Pentagon watchdog report finding Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth risked endangering troops by sharing sensitive information about U.S. strikes on Yemen in a Signal group chat. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A bipartisan group of senators has introduced a war powers resolution seeking to block the White House from launching an attack on Venezuela without congressional authorization after President Trump said a land attack will start very soon. The resolution was co-sponsored by Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer, Tim Kaine, and Adam Schiff, along with Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who wrote, quote, "The American people do not want to be dragged into endless war with Venezuela without public debate or a vote. We ought to defend what the Constitution demands, deliberation before war," unquote. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro Wednesday confirmed he spoke by phone with President Trump about 10 days ago, calling the conversation a potential opening for diplomacy.
I received a phone call and spoke with President Donald Trump. I can say that the conversation was in a respectful tone, and I can even say it was cordial between the U.S. president and the president of Venezuela. I add that if this call means there are steps towards a respectful dialogue between states, between countries, then welcome dialogue, welcome diplomacy, because we will always seek peace.
The U.S. Navy commander overseeing the Pentagon's attacks on alleged drug boats is set to testify on Capitol Hill today. Admiral Frank M. Mitch Bradley will provide a classified briefing to select congressional lawmakers about the U.S. attacks on the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have condemned the strikes as murder. The Pentagon's Inspector General is set to release a report today on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's use of the widely available social media app Signal to discuss U.S. airstrikes in Yemen earlier this year. Two people familiar with the report's findings told news outlets Hegseth endangered U.S. troops and using Signal to discuss the strikes with several other senior Trump administration officials. The chat, which included Hegseth's wife and brother, was revealed when The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, was accidentally added to the Signal group. Defense Secretary Hegseth refused to cooperate with the inspector general, refusing to hand over his phone or sit for an interview. This comes as the New York Times is suing the Pentagon over its new press policy that requires media outlets to pledge not to gather information unless defense officials formally authorize its release. Earlier this year, reporters at the New York Times, along with a number of other media outlets, gave up their press passes rather than comply with the Pentagon's new policy. The Times argues in its lawsuit that the Pentagon's policy, quote, is exactly the type of speech and press restrictive scheme that the Supreme Court and D.C. Circuit have recognized violates the First Amendment, unquote. Israeli forces have killed seven more Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in Israel's latest violation of the ceasefire that was declared nearly 2 months ago. Among the dead are five members of a single family, a middle-aged mother, father, their eldest son, and their two young children, killed when Israel bombed their tent in Khan Yunis. The attack targeted the Al-Mawasi evacuation zone, which Israel previously declared a safe area for displaced people. It followed funerals for Palestinians killed in strikes a day earlier. This is Saber al-Sakani, whose family members were killed and wounded in an Israeli attack on Gaza City Tuesday.
I lost my brother and my two nephews. My brother's wife and her daughter are hospitalized in intensive care. We're asking you to stop the wars, for God's sake.
Health officials in Gaza report 366 Palestinians have been killed and 938 injured by Israeli forces since the October 10th ceasefire. Meanwhile, in southern Gaza, hundreds of Palestinians attended a mass wedding for 54 couples in the city of Khan Yunis Tuesday. Organizers called it an act of defiance against Israel's campaign of genocide against Palestinians.
It is a message for the killers and criminals, whether Ben-Gavir or Smotrich or Netanyahu, that our Palestinian people embrace life, cling to life and love life, and that they will continue in their struggle and strife through this mass wedding and all forms of life. We will continue from the middle of the rubble, destruction and death in the city of Hamad, to send a new message that we will rebuild this destroyed city.
In Toronto, protesters interrupted speakers at a prominent debate series Wednesday evening after organizers invited four former senior Israeli politicians to a discussion about the two-state solution for Israel and Palestine without inviting a single Palestinian to the stage. The Monk Debates event featured former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, former Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, and former Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked.
That the Zionist dream is in danger.
In a statement, protest organizers wrote, quote, by putting these individuals on stage unchallenged by any Palestinian voices, the Monk Debates is creating a sanitized academic veneer for genocide. The event manufactures consent for ongoing occupation, launders reputations of officials implicated in war crimes, and rewrites reality by excluding Palestinians entirely, unquote. The Trump administration deployed Federal Border Patrol agents across immigrant communities in New Orleans Wednesday, calling it Operation Catahoula Crunch. Greg Bovino, the senior Border Patrol official who's been the face of President Trump's mass deportation campaign, was seen patrolling the city's French Quarter. A New Orleans resident told the Associated Press he watched agents arresting men outside a home improvement store. The Trump administration says it's seeking to arrest 5,000 people during the surge. It comes as immigration and customs agents have begun a mass arrest campaign in Minnesota targeting Somali American communities in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. The raids follow a cabinet meeting on Tuesday in which Trump called Somalis garbage. Trump then doubled down on his racist rhetoric Wednesday at the White House. After headlines, we'll go to Minneapolis to speak with Omar Fateh, the first Somali American and first Muslim to be elected to the Minnesota State Senate. Meanwhile, immigration advocates and lawyers contend that despite ICE's policy that agents shouldn't detain, arrest, or hold pregnant, postpartum, and nursing mothers, pregnant people are increasingly rounded up, deported, and detained. The ACLU has documented more than a dozen cases of pregnant women housed without proper medical care at the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, and the ICE Processing Center in Louisiana. In one case, a woman was shackled while she miscarried. Another woman with a high-risk pregnancy was placed in solitary confinement. Meanwhile, here in New York City, the news outlet The City is reporting ICE agents arrested a Chinese father named Fei and his six-year-old son, Huan Xin, during an immigration check-in in Manhattan last week. The father was separated from his little boy and taken to an ICE jail in upstate New York. Advocates say nobody knows where Huan Xin, the little six-year-old, is being held. According to the Deportation Data Project, the boy is part of a growing number of children arrested and detained by ICE. This year, ICE arrested 151 children. Meanwhile, a new report by Amnesty International says immigrants held at the ICE jail in Florida known as Alligator Alcatraz were shackled inside a two-foot-high metal cage and left outside without water for up to a day at a time. The report also details, quote, unsanitary conditions, including overflowing toilets with fecal matter seeping into where people are sleeping, limited access to showers, exposure to insects without protective measures, lights on 24 hours a day, poor quality food and water, and lack of privacy. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee released more than 150 new photos and videos of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's private island in the Caribbean. The images show a room with a dentist's chair surrounded by masks, a bedroom, a palm tree-lined swimming pool, and several other living spaces. Democratic Congressmember Robert Garcia, ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, said, quote, these new images are a disturbing look into the world of Jeffrey Epstein and his island. We're releasing these photos and videos to ensure public transparency in our investigation and to help piece together the full picture of Epstein's horrific crimes. We won't stop fighting until we deliver justice for the survivors, unquote. Meanwhile, Epstein's co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, who's currently serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking, is planning to ask a court to release her. That's according to a letter filed at a federal court in Manhattan. Earlier this year, Maxwell was transferred from a federal prison in Florida to a minimum security camp in Texas about a week after she spoke with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, one of President Trump's former lawyers. In labor news, new reporting from the payroll processing firm ADP shows the U.S. economy lost 32,000 jobs last month, led by a drop in small business employment. Most industries laid off workers, with net gains seen only in the hospitality and healthcare sectors. A year ago, the U.S. economy was adding about 200,000 jobs per month. Now it's had its first three-month decline since the 2020 recession. The Trump administration is seeking to slash fuel efficiency standards enacted under the Biden administration. Under current rules, U.S. automakers are required to boost the fuel efficiency of passenger cars and light trucks to about 50 miles per gallon by 2031. The revised standards proposed by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration Wednesday would cut that to just 34 miles per gallon. In a statement, the Center for Biological Diversity wrote, quote, in one stroke, Trump's worsening three of our nation's most vexing problems, the thirst for oil, high gas pump costs, and global warming, unquote. President Trump said Wednesday he'll issue full and unconditional pardons for Democratic Congressmember Henry Cuellar and his wife Imelda, both of whom faced a dozen charges of bribery, money laundering, and conspiracy. According to the indictment, the Cuellars accepted roughly $600,000 worth of bribes from a Mexican bank and an oil and gas company owned by the government of Azerbaijan. On X, the Sunrise Movement said, quote, this is disgusting. Henry Cuellar, the last anti-choice Democrat in the House, sold out his own community for bribes from a foreign government and oil corporation. Then he cozied up to Trump for a pardon while the Democratic establishment stood by and watched, they said. President Trump justified the pardon by praising Congressmember Cuellar's stance on immigration.
He's a respected person. He was treated very badly because he said that people should not be allowed to pour into our country. And he was right. He didn't like open borders.
And in media news, the Paramount Skydance Corporation has more than doubled the proposed breakup fee in its offer to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery as it seeks to outbid rivals looking to acquire the media conglomerate. The proposed merger comes just months after Skydance completed its acquisition of Paramount, the parent company of CBS, and after Paramount agreed to pay $16 million to settle a lawsuit brought by President Trump, who objected to how 60 Minutes edited an interview with Kamala Harris. Paramount board chair and controlling shareholder Sherry Redstone reportedly sought the settlement to ensure the FCC approved Paramount's merger. On Wednesday, Redstone defended the settlement during the Reuters Next Summit here in New York City.
I do believe it was the right decision. I think the trial had been set for 2 years out. The chaos that would have been created over the next 2 years, I'm not sure the company could have survived. The internal distractions, the external distractions, in spite of everything that we were doing in the company, and during those months we became the number four streaming service, nobody was talking about that. All people were talking about was the, you know, distraction of the Trump litigation.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we speak with Matt Duss of the Center for International Policy on negotiations to end the war in Ukraine, as well as the Pentagon watchdog report finding Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth risked endangering troops by sharing sensitive information about U.S. strikes in Yemen on a Signal group chat. Stay with us.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. Born to a throne, stronger than Rome, but violent prone. Poor people's own, but it's my home. All I have known, where I got grown. We would roam out of the darkness. I came the farthest among the hardest. Survival. Learn from these streets. It can be bleak. Accept no defeat. Surrender, retreat. So we struggling, fighting to eat, and we wondering when we'll be free. So we patiently wait for that fateful day. It's not far away, but for now we say, when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call freedom, just like a waving flag, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes. When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back. Oh,
waving flag by the Somali Canadian musician Kanan, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The Pentagon's Inspector General is set to release a report today on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's use of the widely available social media app Signal to discuss U.S. airstrikes in Yemen earlier this year. Two people familiar with the report's findings told news outlets that Hegseth endangered U.S. troops in using Signal to discuss the strikes with several other senior Trump administration officials. The chat, which included Hegseth's wife and brother, was revealed when The Atlantic's editor Jeffrey Goldberg was accidentally added to the Signal group.
We're joined now by Matt Duss, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy and former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Matt, thanks so much for being with us. In a moment, we're going to talk to you about the negotiations around Ukraine. But let's start with this top news, and that is everything that's happening right now with Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, or as he calls himself, the war secretary. If you can start off by talking about what's going to be released today, but many news outlets have already reported on, saying that he shared sensitive information with a reporter and others about attacks on Yemen. Talk about the significance of this.
Right. This happened last year as strikes, U.S. strikes on Yemen against Yemen's Houthi government were about to begin. The Houthis, as people may remember, had been launching strikes on shipping in the Red Sea and on Israel in protest of the Gaza war. The U.S. was about to undertake strikes against the Houthis. As you noted, the journalist Jeffrey Goldberg was included on a Signal chat of senior administration officials in which it apparently now classified information was being shared by the Secretary of Defense, including when the strikes would start and other things that he was not authorized to release. Now, the Secretary of Defense does have the authority to declassify information if he chooses, as does the President, but none of that clearly was done. This was just carelessness. It was reckless. And as the report is going to say, this potentially put U.S. Troops and service members in danger.
And can you talk about the fact that Pete Hegseth refused to sit for an interview or hand over his phone? Is it just up to him, the man who is being investigated himself? And where does Roger Wicker, the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Jack Reed stand on this and this investigation? What do you expect to take place?
Yeah.
Could they force him?
Well, I think Pete Hegseth, much like the president he served, sees himself as essentially above the law, as unconstrained by legal procedures, by his own obligations, apparently to U.S. service members, given that he very clearly put them in danger. So, unfortunately, it's not surprising that he would not sit for an interview. This investigation was a form of oversight, an important form of oversight, but I do think the more important form will come when we see what Congress is going to do about it. You mentioned Senator Wicker, Senator Reid, and the Senate Armed Services Committee. How far do they push this? How aggressively are they going to be toward the administration when this report comes out? And I think the question really does come down to the Republicans, because unfortunately, in general, the Republican leadership has been pretty subservient to Trump. They have not been all that willing to assert their oversight authority. But given the recklessness of this act and also some of these other things that have been piling up around Pete Hegseth, including the strikes on the alleged drug boats that he's facing now, from what I'm hearing, Republican impatience toward him is really, really growing on the Hill. And this could be something that really pushes people over the edge, but we'll have to see.
And very quickly, Matt, today the Admiral Mitch Bradley is expected to testify before Congress about the second strike on that September 2nd boat, what the Trump administration calls drug boats. Of course, they have not presented any evidence. 9 people killed in the first strike, 2 hanging on for dear life, and they then killed them. The significance of what this means and the overall attacks on the boats, as President Trump says, they're going to attack Venezuela directly, imminently. Mm.
Right. Unfortunately, it seems that Pete Hegseth is using Admiral Bradley as a human shield here. We've seen just over the past few days trying to put blame, or not put blame, he's trying to say, I stand behind Bradley, who gave the order. I didn't give the order. They've had multiple stories about what happened, what didn't happen, who gave the order. But it is important to understand this is happening in a context of strikes that are not, clearly not in the context of war. They are unauthorized. As you noted, there has been no proof given that these are drug boats at all, that these people were engaged in anything illegal. And even if they were, it is seems absolutely unnecessary to destroy these boats, to kill these men who have been convicted of no crime.
And of course, not just unnecessary, but the question is if this is just outright murder, if these
That's
are war crimes. And finally, let me ask you about Admiral Alvin Halsey, the African-American head of Southcom, the first black head of Southcom, who's out next week, but was forced out apparently in October after his objections to what's going on with these boats being targeted. The significance of this.
Right. I mean, that happened. There was a wave of firings essentially early in the Trump administration, especially in DOD, a clearing out of senior leaders who were seen to be not with the program, essentially. And that seems to be what had happened here. Discomfort with what was going to be a really aggressive policy toward Latin America. And that's what we're seeing play out. But I do think, as you noted, while this is you know, really, really, I would say, objectionable and clearly criminal, it does come in the context of years and decades of U.S. abuse and U.S. violations around the world. So we need to take a deeper look at the authorities that have been given and abused by successive administrations, not just this one.
Matt Duss, you're the executive vice president at the Center for International Policy and also a former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. We also want to ask you about the ongoing negotiations to end Russia's war on Ukraine. On Tuesday, President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and son-in-law Jared Kushner met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow for nearly 5 hours, but a deal to end the war in Ukraine was not reached. Russian officials described the talks as constructive, but said no compromise was reached on certain issues.
Witkoff and Kushner are set to meet today with Ukraine's lead negotiator in Florida for further talks. Meanwhile, Putin is now in India meeting with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. This all comes as Germany's foreign minister has criticized Russia, saying he had seen no serious willingness on the Russian side to enter into negotiations. And NATO says, of course, that they're going to continue to supply U.S. weapons, pay for and then supply U.S. weapons to Ukraine. Where does all this stand, Matt?
I think, first of all, I would say efforts to end this war through diplomacy are good, and I commend them. I think most Americans would like to see this war end. Certainly the Ukrainians want this war to end. The Europeans want this war to end. But once again, I think we have arrived at the same place, which is that Vladimir Putin does not want this war to end, certainly not on terms that would be remotely acceptable to Ukraine, by which I mean a resolution to this war that sustains and preserves Ukraine's independence, its democracy, and its ability to defend itself. I think a lot of people were kind of surprised by the extent to which the 28-point plan that was leaked a few weeks ago really essentially, you know, echoed Russia's preferences. Some people said it was written in Russia. I don't know if that's true, but it clearly did reflect a lot of Vladimir Putin's own preferences for how the war should end. As an opening bid, I don't think we should make too much of it. It is good that these talks are going on. But again, I think we've arrived at the same place, which is that the person who has a very, very important vote here, Vladimir Putin, is not supporting an end to the war.
Well, it's extraordinary, Matt, because I did read over those 28 points, and it does seem, as many have commented, that most of Russia's demands have been met. So what explains their resistance to this proposal? And what parts did they umbrage with that they don't want to agree to?
Well, I think there are issues. You know, there was, you know, kind of a negotiation going on within the Trump administration. You know, Witkoff and Kushner put out this plan or were involved in constructing. And initially, Secretary of State Rubio then made changes internally. There's a kind of fight between the Rubio and the Vance wing and the Trump administration here, with the Vance wing being much more aggressively trying to end this war. I think that some of the key concerns were the kind of agreement that Ukraine would not join NATO as a promise. That's, some people see that as unacceptable. Personally, my own view is everyone, I think, understands that Ukraine will not be joining NATO. I understand that you don't want to take that off the table at the outset of negotiations, but I don't think that should be, that shouldn't be allowed to be a roadblock to an agreement. At the same time, I also don't think that is the only thing that concerns Russia. As I said, Vladimir Putin's goals here, in my view, have not changed. I've seen no evidence that his initial goal of curtailing Ukraine's independence and bringing it back under essentially Russian authority as a part of a broader Russian imperium, that remains his ultimate goal. And